conscious of going like this until you kind of catch yourself.
But also at that time, besides digital cameras, people who didn't have digital cameras, they, all these different services came out with, and you could send your film and then only pick to print the ones that you really wanted. Right. So
those services predated Friendster. Ophoto launched in, I think, 98. And they didn't really take off until the digital cameras came along. It turned out that, it was interesting, I just had a student do an exquisite corpse in the thing about networks class. Do an exquisite corpse where you take something, you modify it, and move along. And it was done in camera, as it were. It was a Mad Lib with a digital camera. And the end part of the network is you had to walk the camera to the Kmart, and that hurdle alone was enough to make. And in fact, at one point, who was it? Who had the camera and couldn't give it away?
But
in our class, who was given the camera and tried to give it to?
Spencer.
Spencer, right. So Spencer got the camera, and he explained what you had to do with the camera as he was trying to hand off, and he tried to give it to two different people who refused to take it, because the idea of leaving the floor and going to Kmart was too high on her. So it takes very, very little in terms of extra difficulty to get people to opt out.
He didn't tell.
Yeah, I don't know Maya. I've never had Michael in class, but I recognize him. He tricked somebody into doing it by just not telling him that this is one of the rules, and they handed it to him, and then it showed up on the on the set of rules. But you know, the explosion of photography, which a bunch of people bet on from the film conversion world, didn't really happen until it went digital. In fact, Kodak just got out of the business of making black and white film paper altogether, because the whole thing is going away. But humans are preternaturally good at reading faces. Of everything you can do in 100 pixels by 100 pixels, we get so much more information by looking at each other's faces than almost anything else. We can tell age, gender, we can guess it. What someone does for a living, we can guess at what they make. I mean, it's astonishing. If you show people a collection of coffee cups, and you were to ask them, how many ounces do you think each coffee cup is? No one knows, right? No one knows. Who knows? Who cares? Right? You could show them snapshots of faces in 100 and a half a second. They can tell you how many men and women were there. They can tell you how many adults and children were there. We're so good at that. And a face is the most informative thing you can do in 100 by 100 pixels. And so it's not just narcissism, although obviously there is a certain narcissy pleasure in Friendsters. Right, exactly. Yeah, what was it? What was the great quote? It's a combination of, narcissism, sycophancy, and voyeurism.
It's interesting because a lot of government organizations now, instead of asking you to take a passport picture wherever in a Photoshop, they ask you for a JPEG. And then I was thinking that it gives, first of all, it gives the whole new business of, you know, people that make these JPEGs for you, because apparently a lot of people don't know how to do it. But another thing is, like, I took my own picture. I could Photoshop it, I could do a lot of things to it, I could even change my hair color or whatever. So what does it mean that we are now also the authority of creating our own images to these places?
For what usage? For passport?
I use it for my green card application. We took our own pictures.
And for the visa lottery as well, that's
really?
Even more...
That's a nice built-in thing, because you can't make it look too different than you do. Because it's also
right.
The purpose of linking to you in some way.
In
so people look at it like, oh.
Right.
You have to verify it with a signature of somebody official, like a doctor.
But you have to show your ear, and
they tell you more or less what they want you to do on a white background and so on, but and they give you the dimension and the resolution. But apart from that, you can do...
But the thing is that if you do something weird, then that would not identify you.
But it would be really interesting to see if you could do something where when you've got the two side by side, you make the recognition, but if you just have the photo, you couldn't pick the face out.
Right.
I mean, I wonder if psychologically there's a set of changes you could make. Like
In Latin America, when you turn in a resume, you have to turn in a photo with your resume.
Yeah.
Like, you can't get a job without showing a photo.
Yeah, with your picture.
My
I don't know. But yeah,
opinion
I think that.
Is that it's such a, in my country specifically, it's such a classist society that
that
your image has a lot of like interpretations of
like
your image has a lot of it, like the color of your skin.
So this is like you have to look more European in order to be
like
able to get a better job than
like
if you
also
look
what
more
you wear or
what
you
wear.
You
it's more
your
physical features.
This is part of it because there's you can stage these little photo shoots, right? I could dress myself up as a yacht captain and list myself on Match.com or whatever. But in addition to signals you're giving, there's signals you give off, right? We can read things about one another that are difficult to hide that we don't even know we're giving off, and we're really, really good at recognizing faces. And weirdly, we're incredibly bad about controlling our own facial expressions in complicated or emotional situations, right? You can really tell when someone is interested or not interested or upset or angry or happy or whatever. And, you know, you see it when you go through, when you look at a lot of pictures, whether it's Match or Hot or Not or Live Journal or Friends or any of it, right? There's pictures where you see somebody and think, ah, they're trying too hard.
Yeah.
Right, and like that's a kind of judgment that's incredibly sophisticated relative to looking at any given object, and yet you know instantly when you see one of those photos. There was actually I'll see if I can find it for the second half of the class. There was a great thing deconstructing Friendster photos. It was a joke, but it was forwarded around about a year and a half ago. Sort of showing classic Friendster style poses, and then saying what the person who took this photo thought it meant and what it actually means. I'll see if I can dig that up during the break.
That's a big thing I remember during the whole .com boom in San Francisco and all those companies. At some point, it became a big thing for these first startups to post photos and a little bit of a bio about who was in the company. And as like somebody searching for work or going and evaluating other companies and coming across it, there were so many that came across that were just, you know, right off. And some, there was a certain style that had kind of impacted the group of how you would write your profile and bio to be like a certain thing. But then the pictures, you could just kind of read it all from like, if there's a little bit of the office background or just, you know, the way you're dressed and the whole thing. But it was really weird. I remember coming across that and evaluating companies based on like profiles and just like somebody
right. Well, clearly, I mean, so
a lot of magazines they put in the front their contributor cool images, and it's less
passive. Yeah, and the you know, in I think it was in the early 90s, the ubiquitous author photo in the book jacket. Before it's like, why do I care what the person who wrote the book looks like? And then at some point, you know, we came to care in the same way, you know, from the Video Killed the Radio Star, right? What a pop star looked like suddenly became much more important in the age of MTV. But yeah, I mean, it obviously wasn't effective for Turbo Tim. I mean, the astonishing thing is during all of this, he gets not one, he's at least partially looking for dates. He gets nothing except one woman who told him to go buzz off, which he regarded as a kind of success because he'd gotten a reaction. You know, I mean, one of the really interesting things, I mean, to our constant theme of autonomy versus sociability, is that Friendster heightened autonomy in a sort of anomaly social network. Actually, he's having very little social interactions with the service. He's mostly just garnering an audience for his pictures. So turning from that to the more serious reading. The more serious reading of 2 weeks ago, the one we didn't finish last week, which is Net Paradox. What axis, if you had to link the Friendster reading and the Net Paradox reading, what is it about Turbo Ted that's addressed in the Net Paradox? What characteristic or what sort of personality trait of his does the Net Paradox reading touch on?
Extrovert, introvert.
Extrovert, introvert. What happens with extroverts and introverts? According to this paper, I mean, obviously the literature still roasts the young on these kinds of surveys. What happens to introverts with heavy net use?
More
introverted. What happens with extroverts?
More extroverted.
So it turns out to be an amplifier rather than having any particular effect. The original, the reason that I think they, I forget how deeply they discussed this, but the reason it's called Internet Paradox Revisited is the original study in Pittsburgh in 97, I think, or 98, followed a group of people over a year right after they got net access and found that social capital, most measures of social capital decreased. And that paper is called The Internet Paradox. It's every time we poll users and ask them what they do, when we ask them theoretically, what is this going to be useful for, it's always the sort of puritanical, I am going to use this to look up information. And when we ask them what they actually do, or better, we watch them, it's invariably some form of personal or group communication top of the list. And in some cases, the top three places out of all their activities, whether it's email or playing games or one another thing. So Internet Paradox Revisit was an attempt to go back at that. And they offered some explanations for the difference between the two studies, why the Pittsburgh study may have found this decline in social capital, and why their study had found instead that extroverts get a lot of value in terms of social capital out of the network and introverts don't. If you had to describe the change in the internet in this country between, say, 98 and 2003, was this? Oh, no, 2001. Between 98 and 2001. What was the biggest change?
IM.
What's that?
IM.
Oh, that's interesting. Well, IM had already appeared by 98, although it certainly got you back. I mean, ICQ was fall of 96, but it certainly got more ubiquitous. So that is one change. It was a much more common use of IM. What else?
From text to more of like image-based internet.
Interesting. Well, there certainly was a growth.
Blogging.
What's that?
Blogging.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. There was a lot more personal application. But what? I mean, and they in particular laid at the feet of social density. Where in addition to the individual service that launched, the big change in their view is there's just many, many more people online. And what happens when there's more people online? In a local community like this. This is again done in Pittsburgh in order to go back to the original text.
A variety of groups.
What's that?
A variety of more groups.
Right. And there's more people you know, more of the people you know offline are also online. In 1998, and certainly prior to 98, this is alluded to in Psychology of the Internet, your friends on the internet were your imaginary friends, right? I mean, they were not. I mean, somebody was talking about this in the beginning with me. I think maybe it's Marie talking about. You know, I know all these people online, and then I can't invite them out bowling, right? Because to have friends online meant your friend they weren't friends that were near you because you were forced to pick between real-world friends and friends online.
That's sometimes true, but a lot of internet was like through schools or...
Right, but in the case of the Pittsburgh study, the group they found that got online were people where it was being offered by the local phone company, so they weren't in aggregate. For people under 30, there was not so much time. There were many less places where you were pushed to that choice because you tended to go in and your immediate physical cohort and undergraduate was also wired. But for people getting it through, in existing communities getting it through the phone company, there just wasn't the opportunity to have mediated interactions with people you also had unmediated interactions with, live interactions with.
Yeah, they said the audience is much more diverse than like, the average internet user, which would totally skew it.
Right, exactly.
You don't have to find anybody related to you.
Right, right.
Isn't there a factor that the early adopters profile is also a specific one in terms of the users?
No, that's interesting. Yes, the early adopter is a very different profile. And it may be just that having gone back, I don't remember if they mentioned that either. That's a good question. I don't know. Right. I mean, if they may effectively have gone with people who were willing to be loners and were less susceptible to social pressure and trying new things, but therefore skewed to people whose social capital is going to decline in this environment, skewed to introverts. That's a really interesting question. I don't know if they mentioned that here.
Why do people keep using the internet if it, like, if you're like making you feel worse or whatever, do you not realize it? Is you're addicted to it, or why?
Go into a bar sometime at 3 in the morning and ask them a similar question. Anyway, and there are lots of things we do that seem right in the short term. I mean, you must have had the experience of, I should be logging out now. I should stop reading /. I'm not gonna look at boing boing one more time. And then 15 minutes later, or you're lucky if it's 15 minutes. So I think that there are those kind of potato chip moments where short-term engagement. But also, if we take seriously the tension between autonomy and sociability, it may well be that the improved leverage in autonomy, right? I've got all these extra things I can do because the computer is letting me or helping me do them. That may seem like such a big win that you don't notice the decline in social capital. In fact, one of the big Meetup was founded in part because Scott read Putnam's book, Bowling Alone. And one of the theses of Bowling Alone is that there were such wrenching social changes in the era of suburbanization that people didn't notice the loss of social capital being one of those things. One interesting question would be, if we regard social capital as a good, are there ways we could maximize it for introverts? So that it is a leap to do it, but let's take the leap and say, loss of social capital among introverts is already bad. I mean, is a bad thing. What would we do to reverse that? If we wanted to reverse that, what steps could we take?
Push for like meeting somewhere.
Mm-hmm. And like, how would you do that?
That's tough.
Yeah.
The engineer blackout.
I ask you, probably, that's really good.
That
that's really out. Good. I ask in part because there is a design movement on college campuses that's working on exactly that problem. College campuses have tended to maximize the amount of autonomy students have because the undergraduate education is geared at educating the individual, and given the amount of capability a single Ethernet jack moves into the individual dorm room, colleges have found that they've built these environments which are turning increasingly into monk's cells rather than environments for socialization. And so they're redesigning the physical enclosure of college to counterbalance the negative effects of the network.
To increase social interaction.
But blackouts are really good. I don't know if I've heard anybody suggest that. But just staging the occasional campus-wide net failure or blackout.
But this idea is almost like...
I was at work on Thursday, and I've been working at this office for the summer. And it's been really odd because everyone is in touch with someone somewhere else in the world. And it's in a cube farm, and it's dead silent. And I've really never had any conversations with anybody. And I came in on Thursday, and there was a lot more conversation going on. People were talking to each other on either side or whatever. And I went and I logged in, and my connection was down. And then I had to go into the help desk, check out what's going on with that. And it was such a long wait that, piecing together after a few minutes that there was no network. And for the whole day, it was the first time I went to work in there for about 7 months that I got to know anybody. I mean, it was really...
So what would happen if we cut the Ethernet cable, if we cut rather the strand of glass coming to this floor?
It's before they put the suicide prevention thing.
Oh, a joke.
The idea of the blackout is actually it's I don't remember from which articles, from all the articles, but they're suggesting what happens when there's a few people in an elevator or in a subway. There is no, you can identify them as a group, but there is no social interaction between them. But only when there's similar to a blackout.
That's small groups of complex systems. It's the fourth quadrant of their four-quadrant map. and it is the self-formed but accidental group. And it's a very rare class for that reason. Most groups tend to be, you know, motivated and arranged in the other three quadrants. But yeah, that's
but can you increase these motivations?
That's
can you,
a really
when you create these?
What would happen if we cut off packets for half a day on the floor? Would people socialize more, or would they flee?
They would flee.
They'd go outside.
Here.
Go get a drink.
But you could go downstairs to the coffee shop. I mean, you could only do it on the floor unless you did it to the whole building.
Yeah. People would go home.
Yeah. Well, people at my office on Thursday wound up leaving and going home. Because sure. We have too much to do.
The thing is that if we do it now, we're so used to it, and we need it so much now. We need it so much that it'll take chaos until we get used to it again. No, in that sense, it was interesting that in 97, like up to 97, I don't know when actually started really happening. It was 97, 98. Most European universities were not giving individual emails to students. So they would have like a collective email address for like a bunch of people.
Oh.
And I remember I went to Denmark then, and in Mexico, everyone had an email address. So to go to Europe and people don't have email, like, wow, we were advanced. And it was just a funny situation because, like, yeah, people, like, they were not socializing on email as much as we were.
Sure, I bet not. Because you couldn't say anything really intimate to somebody knowing that your roommate might pick it up and have to deliver
it. Exactly. So it was a very, it was like a bulletin board, like a corporate somewhere, posted messages.
So what do they say in here, I mean, this sort of, on the blackout thing, what do they say in here about strong relationships in Internet Paradox with the group?
That they grow stronger if you know the people before. Okay.
What do they say about strong relationships forming online?
They don't form.
They don't. Yeah. Right. It's incredibly rare to find real strong relationships forming in an entirely mediated fashion. Not impossible, but quite rare.
In order to get strong, they have to meet.
Right. And you know, we've been hearing, I think almost literally every year since the 1964 World's Fair with the launch of that video phone. Someday we hope that video phones will offset the need for business travel. Right, and we've heard every year that communications and travel are these sort of substitutes for one another. And yet we've been through a massive deregulation of travel in the late 70s, massive deregulation of telecommunications in the early 80s, and they both keep going up. So travel and communication seem actually to be complements to one another rather than substitutes for one another. And I think I don't know if everyone will have had the experience, because you guys may have been more involved with people who were physically proximate, but for those of us of a certain age, we have all had the experience after a while of getting on a plane to go meet someone that you've only talked to online, which can often be a shock. Because you create, and I don't know whether it's less of a shock these days with faces, but literally going from text only to there you are, you know, in the same place as this person was a big switch of context. And it just occurred to me for the first time that may happen to you all less than it happened to my core. Who's gotten on a plane to go meet someone that they only knew online?
You mean metaphorically or specifically airplane and online?
Just to get on the plane?
Actually,
I mean, I guess I mean specifically airplane and online.
This was work related, and I wasn't the one who got on the plane. The other person came to meet me.
Right, but did they come to meet you, or did they come to do?
They came to meet the team because we had only worked with this person via phone and email.
Yeah.
I went to a conference once where I think I did know a few people there who I hadn't met. I'm not sure, but it was definitely like a convergence of people.
Right.
But then I think for all of us pretty much with here, I mean, like, you correspond with Midori quite a bit about stuff, and then eventually.
Look, if you didn't get on a plane to come meet Midori, it was a shock.
But Midori got on a plane to come meet us in California.
Yeah, but she's paid to. No, I mean.
Just a one-on-one non-associate.
I mean, no offense. I mean, I'm sure she's happy to meet you, but. No, it's funny because it is absolutely a litmus test among my generation. That people would go to these meetings. And in fact, one of the things Scott found with Meetup, when he found Meetup, he expected it to be
Chihuahua owners, car owners, you know, classic American-style affinity groups. Top three groups, week after we launched, FARC, LiveJournal, Slashdot. It was these groups that were largely distributed, knew one another only through these kind of non-geographic text-oriented media, who then were eager to draw together in local clusters.
But I would say that if you do meet this person, even once, it might be like a setting for a stronger relationship than meeting him constantly.
Oh, then meeting constantly. Oh, that's
because in some cases, because you get the, like, you see the person, you see how you communicate, even if you communicate, like, you meet him once in, like, one meeting, and all the rest continues online. Then you are not, if you pass the you know, the first test of, are you repelled by this guy or something like that? You basically can continue your virtual communication with this guy and not be subjected to the problems of keeping, like, I had a romantic relationship like that.
Mm-hmm.
Very, very problematic.
Yes, it is.
Yeah. It is something that can achieve, like, this ideal setting.
Right, and I think that is more normal pre-photos, pre-match.com. That experience is more normal for my group than it probably is for people using the internet in their 20s now.
But there was a telephone before that. I think the same.
You know, I remember applying for a job. And we were driving through Massachusetts in the driving rain, and I was unable to find a hotel. Oh, I guess something wrong with the dial-up connection. I remember, like, trying to get in touch with this person to say something other about the job interview. And I was driving with my girlfriend at the time, and she said, "Wait, we could call them." There was just a moment where I forgot that the telephone existed for a fairly large, like, once you switched over to using the network. And it was in part because the phone, there were no mobile phones, it was in part because SMS wasn't around, so there was nothing that bridged the gap between data and voice. But there was a long period where to use the phone was a kind of failure. I mean, it was sort of kicking back into this, you know, whatever, 19th century convention.
It's happening a bit now with the free internet telephone. Ever since I got here, I never called Israel in the regular
phone. Right, and now it's, yeah.
Like, if somebody wants to talk with me, they'll have to install Skype.
But there's that weird thing that Skype does too, about talk to anybody else who's out there now, which is always like, to me, but it's clearly something you do right in the beginning when it's so rare that you just do anything to broker a conversation. And that button is going to go away within 6 months because everybody uses Skype. And
somebody did that on the ITP radio. Like,
what, Skype somebody?
They just kept on Skyping people and asking them what, like, to play music.
Oh, that's great.
Over the Skype.
But. That's great. Who did that?
Joanne saw that.
That's great.
So actually, at some, before coming here to New York, like, the previous 3 years, I totally gave up the phone.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I would not communicate with people more than an email.
Oh, see, I'm trying to go the opposite way.
You're trying to go back to the phone?
Get rid of email.
Now I'm trying to do it, yeah, the opposite.
Yeah.
I have really, really close friends in different places of the world, and the only reason that they're still really close friends is because of Messenger. Like, that's our only means of communication,
right.
But I have closer relationship with them than I have with anybody who's physically here. So.
I have that with my mother.
With Messenger. I remember when we sold... Oh, it's okay.
No, it's not... It's funny, a few years ago I did babysitting on these two girls that came from Israel, and they had no friends here in the US, and they were still I am with people from Israel, and, like, the whole day long. Or then when they start having friends here, I don't know, this generation is just amazing. They come back from school and they're just, like, the whole day chatting with their friends from school about things. It's just like the whole day they're on the computer.
I used to speak on the phone with the friends from school all day.
Right, so...
But with eyesight, with like video chat, it's a completely different experience. Like,
but it's not catching.
It's odd. I mean,
but I just started.
You're in a situation where you're forced
so
to be
intense.
In front of something
all
the time, which is not natural. You have to, if you're not looking directly at the person, then it's kind of, oh, maybe they're not interested in what you're talking
but
about.
But this is, it's voyeuristic at some point. It's like, because you're like watching the person type, or like feel in their apartment. It's just so weird. Yeah.
I don't use it.
It's like a spy cam.
But you have the option of voice only,
yeah.
And that's really cool because I can be doing homework and talking to somebody else
mm-hmm.
who is doing homework elsewhere.
The only people I know of that use the video chat are separated couples. Dana Carwas used it religiously. Yeah, I think she was around last year, maybe 2 years ago. But for her boyfriend was in
Colombia,
right? And that's a situation where the visual seems to make a difference.
Yeah.
But in almost no other situation is it? What's that?
I think also
mm-hmm.
young families babies,
right.
New babies,
and also the grandparents,
mm-hmm.
holidays.
The typical AT&T commercial.
Yeah.
My grandfather asked me to install a camera for him so he can study study the Bible with one of the other relatives that was in the U.S.
The new iMacs come with the camera already embedded.
Oh wow.
So I'm really wondering to see whether that's gonna
It's been literally every year since 1964, a press release somewhere has come out. It said video phones are the wave of the future. And it's never happened.
And
I think it's in part, I mean, Richard Foreman did a play years ago called Film's Evil, Radio is Good in the basement, in the second floor here. But one of the observations in Film's Evil, Radio is Good is that film is a totalitarian medium. It freezes you. And you have to look and listen. It locks you down. Whereas radio, you can wander around the house and be looking at and doing other things. And the overt locking down that a video phone does, right? I mean, the first thing I want to do is get a James Caan mask and just put it up so I can sort of be moving around or something.
So like when we get those little robot cameras, when we finally get the video chat.
Yeah, I just the value when you're attenuating. I've attenuated down to voice has been, you know, really from the minute the phone came out. No one ever had to predict a day when the phone might catch on, right? We've had the technology for video phones working, not just possible, but working since 1964. And there's a handful of cases where it's valuable. One of them is engineers who are using the video to look at artifacts. Instead of each other's faces, another's family groups, whether it's couples or it's lonely. I had the experience of having a long meet, like a 4-hour long meet with somebody attending by video phone. It's for the Library of Congress. I was later the chair of the technical committee designing their preservation network, and one of the members of the committee was this engineer from HP, and it was only a year after the committee wound up its work and we issued our report that I realized that he was the guy that I had the video meeting with. There are so few emotive cues, right, of the kind that we get with being in the real room with the same person that come off the video screen right now. I understand that HP has a, you know, these rooms that are totally optimized for, like, they bought the kind of wood that looks best under these lights on this particular camera, kind of mixing and matching. Where you do start to get limbic cues, but it's gonna take a long time for that.
It might be a resolution issue too.
It's, you know, if it's a resolution issue, it's awfully high because we've seen significant bumps in resolution sort of continuously, and it's never the lag thing is crazy. I mean, that's part of it, but it seems to be just a lot of it is just the limbic, you know, the emotional cues. All right, let's take a break. When we come back, I want to look at three pieces of software and talk about the group effects with these ideas in mind.
Are we going to go to the